want me to yell at him?
Okay, we're going to do it.
Okay, call to order the House Committee on Education. Welcome. Nice to see all of you here. We've got actually a wonderful agenda today. We're going to be going here and finding some updates on what's going on in Department of Ed and so on. And then also we have the Teacher of the Year here to talk about it. And then a presentation on dual language and moving some of us into the digital age when it comes to textbooks. So first of all, the first thing we need to do is adopt rules. So I would like to open up an organizational meeting and seek a motion to adopt the committee rules.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Okay, Rep. Frederick moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk, would you please read the roll?
Representative Barato.
Aye.
Representative
Pat. Here.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Clouseau.
Here.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Schreiner. Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. And if we could give some clarification from Representative Hack, are you here, or was that an affirmative or a negative?
That's affirmative.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. The motion passes and the rules are adopted. Okay. First, I'd like to introduce, who's coming up first? Lindsay? Or? Okay. We introduce our first thing, kind of an update as to what's going on in the Department of Education and the Chief Executive Officers. So, Dr. Noor and Mr. Capps. Okay. So I'm opening up an informational hearing on education stuff.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Frederick, and Vice Chair Springer, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lindsay Capps, Acting Chief Education Officer and Education Policy Advisor to Governor Kate Brown. I'm here today to provide you an update on the work across state education agencies from cradle to career. In doing so, I will outline some of the governor's priorities and as they are reflected in partnership with the legislature in the education budget for the current 2015-17 biennium. And the second piece that I'll do is just talk a little bit about the role of the Chief Education Office has been conceived and will be enacted under Senate Bill 215, which was passed this past legislative session. In terms of key priorities, Governor Brown feels strongly that we must do all we can to, first and foremost, close the opportunity gap. And that means ensuring the success of every student in Oregon, especially those in underrepresented communities as well as rural communities. We want to make sure that the governor wants to make sure that every student graduates high school with a plan, whether that means pursuing a college degree in a chosen field or entering the workforce with needed skills to build a career and contribute to the economic vitality of their community. And lastly, the governor feels very strongly about continuing to build a seamless system of education from cradle to career. So that means that our focus is on tight coordination and effective implementation across the system and among education agencies from early learning to higher education. And this is a key charge of the Chief Education Officer. So let me begin with our work in early learning, which really begins when families bring home their child, when our children are born. Through a network of partners working in tandem, we want to ensure that every last child has the building blocks for a successful start in school and life. Through this budget, we've expanded home visiting services to all families that requested it in the last biennium. And we funded early learning hubs, which have moved from demonstration sites to the place in which we will coordinate the delivery of critical services to children and families in every region of the state. We also need to provide affordable, high-quality early learning experiences to each Oregon child through creating a variety of options for preschool and expanding access to kindergarten. We are beginning to lay the foundation essential for children to be ready to read by third grade and be successful throughout school. We're excited to be in the emerging steps of expanding Head Start, as well as moving toward the implementation of a mixed delivery preschool model by the middle of the biennium. Another aspect of focus in preparing our students to be ready to graduate high school with a plan is engaging learning. Learning should motivate and inspire students, and learning ought to connect students with real-world application. From our classrooms to communities, we should foster opportunities for the next generation of thinkers, doers, and creators. That starts with stable and adequate funding to ensure we have a well-rounded and well-balanced curriculum for all students, regardless of where they go to school. And we're also prioritizing that through the expansion of career technical education and STEM education through more college-level coursework offered or dual credit offered in high school, especially in high need and rural communities, and we'll see that work emerging through the Senate Bill 481 work group, as well as additional policy work we'll need to do, as well as through the regional promise sites. Students need supports, critical wraparound services, mentoring, academic advising, and we need to do more to re-engage out-of-school youth. And that's another priority that's reflected in a number of the budget priorities this session. And we need high-quality teachers and school leaders in every classroom and every school. We're excited to see continued investment in the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning to support programs that provide high-quality preparation, mentoring, professional development for teachers, leadership training for school administrators on school transformation, critical coaching and support for low-performing schools and districts, and improved student assessment, which I'm sure is something that Dr. Nora will talk about in his report from the Oregon Department of Education. The other piece we need to do is thinking about post-secondary education and providing options for the future. Students can be more engaged in their learning and see the choices that they have if they can select a field that's meaningful to them. So we need to create a spectrum of opportunities for Oregon students that ensures each graduates high school with a plan and multiple opportunities for prosperity. This begins with college access and affordability. By making our systems of higher education affordable and accessible, we can do more to harness the potential of each Oregon student. We were excited to see work this past session to expand the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We will serve another 16,000 Oregon children and families through this program, and we will be basing this program on need rather than first come, first serve, which will expand the opportunity to help our highest need students. And we're excited to see the work around the Oregon Promise to provide tuition remission for students who want to go to their local community college. I want to go back to one point that I said at the beginning about closing the opportunity gap, and this is some critical work that our school's chief is, I know, helping to foster. The first is continuing our efforts to focus on and support English language learners and our bilingual education programs. We are looking forward to the development of the statewide plan to strengthen achievement among African American students. The establishment of tribal attendance pilots, which we just met with the Sovereign Nations just this last week to talk about implementation of those attendance grants, as well as increasing funding and coordination to provide opportunities to students to achieve a GED and advance to college and or career opportunities. So that gives you a framework, if you will, or a landscape for a number of the initiatives that we are in the process now across education agencies implementing, and sound implementation is our focus. Let me just end with a few comments about the Chief Education Office. Last legislative session, Senate Bill 215 was passed, which really recalibrated the role and focus of the Chief Education Office to most effectively serve the needs of the educational system and achieve student outcomes. We will use our coordinating authority across education agencies to help build the seamless system that is so important to this governor. That means leading cross-agency planning and collaboration around key transitions, most importantly the pre-kindergarten through third grade transition, where we bring early learning and K-12 partners together, as well as continued policy work around the grade 11 through 14 transition, where we see a number of different work groups currently operating, and we're working together with ODE and HEC, among others, to have broader policy conversations to develop strategies to support student access to those opportunities. We're also continuing our work to develop a coordinated system to link student data, the longitudinal data system, which we are in the process of moving to the next stage. And we're continuing to amplify a focus on equity and the use of the equity lens as we evaluate policy, as well as make budget recommendations through the governor to the legislature. So those are a couple of the areas that we'll be focused on that distinguish us from the agencies in which we'll be working. We'll also be, in doing our work, striving to convene with stakeholders and impacted communities to develop policy and budget proposals. We'll be working to bring together, when necessary, the state boards, whether that be the HEC and the State Board of Education around 11 through 14 transition issues, or the Early Learning Council and the State Board, among other opportunities to bridge each sector of education. And we'll also be working outside of the education realm to make critical connections with leadership in health and social services and the economy to think about ways in which we better support and enhance the learning and outcomes of students. So with that, I will yield my time and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, and we'll wait till both are done before we have some questions. Okay, Dr. Noor.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair Frederick, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to share information with you today. I'm actually on the end of my third month in my new role at the Department of Education, and I'm really grateful to have this opportunity to serve our state and our students in this capacity. I want to tell you that we have been busy working to support our schools and districts throughout the state, especially as we began a new school year. And I hope your kids, grandkids, brothers, sisters, family members have had a wonderful start to the school year as well. That's a very exciting time for me. It's a very special time. I want to share with you that we just released the state assessment results on the 17th of September, and I'm really pleased to report that our students did much better than what was originally anticipated. And I want to take this moment to recognize our students and their hard work, but most importantly, to recognize the hard work of our teachers and administrators and school personnel that work with students to make sure that they are better prepared to take this new and more rigorous assessment. So that is something for us to celebrate. I also want to recognize that there is much work to do. There is room for improvement and growth, and we will continue to support our schools and districts towards that end. Excuse me. I also want to just build on a couple of things that Lindsay shared with you. We jointly have started some conversations statewide around improving our graduation rate. I know that's something that the legislature is interested in. Many of our stakeholders are interested in that conversation, and we will keep you updated as that conversation actually unfolds. We're looking at both how we compare to other states, but also looking at specific strategies that will help us improve our graduation rate across all student groups. And I'm really optimistic and looking forward to that work. Another conversation that we are also beginning, and Lindsay and I are working together on this, is statewide conversations around our assessment and accountability system. What should that look like? The reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act potentially affords us that opportunity, but we believe that this conversation is timely. Many of our school leaders and community leaders are interested in looking at assessment in our state. What does it mean? What should it look like? How do we get the most out of it to make sure that students are successful and progressing adequately as they advance through our system? And you have to link that to accountability, so it will allow us to examine the accountability system that we currently have and bring some balance to it. So balanced assessment is something that you're going to hear a lot about, and I'm looking forward to those conversations as well. All of these initiatives are being considered through the lens of equity and also increasing student achievement. So that's really what's driving those conversations. Students are at the center of all of those conversations. At this time, I'd like to just share with you some implementation updates on some of the legislation that you passed, thank you, in the previous session. ODE, as you may not know, we tracked 372 bills during the 2015 session. Of those, 110 became law that the department now needs to implement. And instead of going through all of them, of course, I will just highlight some of those bills that may be of interest to you, and I've categorized them under headings like funding, assessment, CTE, et cetera. So I think in the area of funding, the legislature increased overall funding for schools. Funding for the high-cost disabilities grant continued, the small schools grant, and changed the base ESD funding floor from $1 million to $1.3 million. It also added free lunch for all students for the biennium for approximately $2.5 million that will be matched by the federal government at double that amount. That is a bill that was led and supported greatly by Chair Doherty. Thank you. I just want to share with you that all of those changes in the funding formula have been made, so schools are actually receiving their allocations based on the changes that you implemented in the previous session. This takes me to assessment, and we have two key bills that passed last session, House Bill 2655 and House Bill 2680. House Bill 2655 is often referred to as the opt-out bill. I want to inform you that it's being implemented. We're working on creating the opt-out form and writing a parental notification sample for districts. We will be revising the rules and the test manual, so all of the changes that are in the bill will be reflected in the documentations and the information that the department provides to districts. All of this will be done before January 1st when the bill actually takes effect. We're notifying districts of this change now, and all of the material will be provided to district in November so they can start disseminating that to students and families. The law says that information needs to be provided to families 30 days before the assessment begins. The assessment doesn't actually begin until February, so this will allow districts approximately 3 months to have that information and to start engaging parents and family around that topic. I also will share with you that House Bill 2655, which is called the Student Assessment Bill of Rights, requires districts to inform parents not just of their rights to the right to opt out their student from the assessment, but it requires districts to provide them information on the purpose of the assessment, how the assessment will be used, what is the overall effect of the assessment for the student, the school, the district, the state. Also, it advises the district to provide information to parents on how students will be supported once the assessment results are in hand. So if the student is at a level one or two, that requires some supports and interventions that the school needs to provide for that student. If they're at a level three or four, that requires some additional supports in order to stretch the student and expand their learning. So all of that information is being developed and will be provided to districts by November. House Bill 2680 directs ODE to convene a work group to look at results of the Smarter Balance assessment and analyze those results. We're validating the results now and expect to convene that work group next month. So we're in the process of identifying potential members for that work group, and we've implemented some of the elements in House Bill 2680. For example, it prevents the state from using the 14-15 data for evaluation purposes. So we've communicated that with districts already. The next category is CTE. The legislature appropriated $35 million for current technical education. Staff are working to send grant funds out to districts, and we're trying to manage that in a very intentional way. We've broken that up into phases, just like we have with many of the other grant funding opportunities you provided us. The CTE revitalization grant RFP is out and in the hands of districts. Staff have conducted a webinar to communicate the opportunity to districts and help them understand the process that they need to go through to apply, the requirements, et cetera. The revitalization grant advisory committee has met and is very actively involved in that process. Staff are currently also working on the career pathways funding grant. They're finalizing formulas and definitions, collecting data, and determining what programs prepare students for high-wage, high-demand careers. That's a requirement in the bill. And we're in the process of hiring the staff members that the legislature has very graciously provided us to help us do this work. Another area of interest to you may be the capital construction matching grants. Senate Bill 447 established the Office of School Facilities within the department and set aside $125 million in bonds to provide matching grants to school districts. The bill is being implemented. Administrative rules are being written. The first advisory task force meeting is planned for early next month. Treasury has very kindly loaned us a person to help us with this process, which has been a tremendous asset and resource for us. And the first grants will match local bonds passed in next May's election. It's a very aggressive timeline, but this is generating a lot of interest both internally and externally. Many of our partners, OSBA, COSA, and others, have been involved in this process. Two bills were passed by the legislature under the heading of equity, as I would label them. House Bill 2016, the legislature provided $2.8 million to develop a statewide education plan for students enrolled in early childhood through post-secondary education who are African American or historically underserved, and to form an advisory group to make recommendations about how to better serve those students. The group was just appointed last week. Actually, we just notified members and sent out appointment letters last week. We have a very diverse group, and they're on a very aggressive timeline to have a report for the legislature in February. So we're looking forward to the work that that group is going to do. House Bill 3499. Thank you. I'm recovering from a cold, and I keep losing my voice. Thank you. House Bill 3499, the legislature allocated $12.5 million from the state school fund to better support English language learners. Two work groups have been created to identify activities that support English language learners and to identify school districts that are not meeting the needs of those students that would be targeted for technical assistance in the form of grants. The two groups, one is focused on the finances and the accounting, if you will, of the funding that's provided to support English language learner. The other is focused more on programmatic elements in terms of instruction, curriculum, material supports, professional development, et cetera. And both of these groups, I think their work becomes really integral to improving the achievement gap, to closing the achievement gap in our state and improving graduation rates, especially with these two populations. So we're very excited about that. We're in the process, in the meantime, we're also in the process of partnering with other agencies to implement bills that were enacted by the legislation in 2015, Senate Bill 418, for example. We're working with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and the Chief Education Office on ways to encourage students to become ready for college, take courses for college credit, and transition from high school to college and the workforce. We're working with the Oregon Health Authority on a task force on school nursing that will be looking at possible health funding sources for school nurses and school clinics. We're partnering with the Department of Justice to communicate the requirements of the new student privacy bills. We're also working with the Chief Education Office on research projects such as poverty and attendance. We're also partnering with Senator Gelser on a task force or a work group relative to fifth-year programs, providing data, resources, information, and actively participating in the conversation. I want to close by sharing with you something that I'm very excited about. When I left the department in 2008, prior to leaving the department, the legislature actually created the Oregon School, the virtual school district, with the intention of providing courses to students that live in rural Oregon that don't typically have access to those courses. And those could be advanced learning opportunities, honors courses, language courses, advanced placement courses, etc. The virtual school district operated within the department for the last 10 years or so, and I'm just pleased to share with you that we've recasted the virtual school district, and now we have 138 rural districts in the state of Oregon that students from those districts can access courses online through the virtual school district. So I am really excited about that because we have real live courses that students can take regardless of where they live in the state of Oregon. And we're hoping to expand those to CTE courses. I know Representative Verdin is very interested in that. So we're hoping to expand those to CTE courses that don't necessarily require hands-on application. But we're excited about that, and I wanted to share that with you because it's something that is that fits under the banner of equity, if you will, providing equitable access to students throughout the state to advance learning opportunities, to honors courses, to Spanish language courses. So we're very excited about that, and I wanted to share that with you. I'm going to stop here, and I welcome any questions, any comments, or feedback from you. And if I didn't address any bills or anything that you're concerned about, I'm happy to talk about that as well.
Thank you.
Before
we ask questions, I neglected to introduce Representative Comp, who is a glutton for punishment. Here she is the co-chair of the Ways and Means on Education, and they did not meet today, so she wanted to find out what was going on in education.
That's
so
right.
We welcome Representative Comp. And then also in your packets was a piece of paper that shows you the link to get to the summary of legislation. And it also gives you an example of what the bills are and how it is. But it's on the OLIS. Well, it's on the OLIS system. If you go to the Oregon, House of Representatives, go to the committee section, and it's about a 200-page document that covers all of the bills that were done. And so I just wanted to point out that resource is there for you also.
Published by Legislative Committee Services.
Thank you. That's published by Committee Services. There we go. Okay. Now questions.
Yes.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. Hello, guys. I have a number of questions, and I'll start off with following your pattern there. You mentioned that the scores were at a different level. What did we learn that our students are missing?
Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, that's a great question, and thank you for asking that question. I am not sure that I can answer that question with any fidelity today. And the reason I say that is because we have to do some research. In fact, it's interesting, I posed that question to our leadership team in the Department of Education this morning because I'm trying to get us to own our data. So we publish the data, and that is school and district data. But I feel that the department has a responsibility to answer that question. So House Bill 2680 will form a task force that will allow us to look at that. But what I can tell you is that the pattern is fairly consistent with the previous assessment, the OAKS assessment. So the gap is essentially the same. We saw some marginal improvement. They're not significant enough to say that we're closing the achievement gap. So the pattern is consistent in terms of the performance of our students of color, our English language learners, students that live in poverty, students with special needs. And I think it's incumbent upon us now to say why, and then so what? What are we going to do about it? What I can tell you from a technical point of view is that the new assessment was challenging for some students because the math assessment in particular, let's use that as an example, not only required students to respond to questions that were open-ended, problem-solving like we used to do in the state of Oregon a long time ago, but the testing modality was slightly different in terms of actually students having to write their responses. So there was a written component to it. There was a communication component where students had to actually explain their responses. So aside from performance, which we know is an issue that we have to look at because we have new standards, they are more rigorous. While I was in the Salem-Keizer School District, our elementary school teachers would tell you that this is middle school level math that we're being asked to teach in elementary school. So there are some challenges that I can talk about. But we are going to do some more in-depth analysis of the data itself to understand what it really tells us, to help us understand how we can begin to close the achievement gap through intervention, supports, professional development. What I can tell you is that districts that use the formative assessment and an interim assessment in combination with the summative assessment did better than those that just did the summative assessment. So I appreciate the question, and I know I'm not giving you a specific answer, but I'm trying to highlight the complexity of trying to really get at that question.
Well, this is the concern that I have that we may be finding out getting more data, but not really getting to the meat of what we need to do in terms of helping our students learn, not helping them to learn to take the test well, but helping them to learn. So that's a significant concern of mine.
Yeah. Yeah, Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, I do appreciate the comment, and what we're concerned about is the learning. You're absolutely right. So what I can tell you from looking at what Beaverton School District did, that the data is really outstanding in terms of the performance of all student groups in Beaverton. And if you were to ask the district, what did you do to increase performance, they will tell you really simple things that we know in education make a difference. So they increased staffing levels in certain schools that needed, where students needed more attention and more personalized learning. They provided more relevant and maybe even culturally, I would say, relevant instructional materials and resources, and provided access to those resources. They provided embedded professional development within their schools. They were really intentional about identifying students that they knew were at risk and provided supports to those students. They worked with the families of those students to make sure that they're receiving additional supports at home that complemented what's happening in school. So we have some bright spots in our state where districts have figured this out, and we will be looking at those and sharing that information. House Bill 3499 and House Bill 2016 also affords us an opportunity to focus on some of our student populations that are most challenged, both academically and in graduation, and to start to identify best practices based on research and based on what we know other districts are doing. So we intend to do that and not just admire the data.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I would contend that we already knew that those students needed that extra help anyway. Yeah. Before this is the information we got, right, before they took the test. So this is not particularly new information. Yeah. It's not as a result of the test. Right. And you know I'm going to have to ask about 2655. I will tell you that I was very concerned about the notice that was sent out by the Department of Education. I found the note to superintendents, to principals, to administrators incredibly patronizing to parents, saying very simply, we don't trust that parents understand, are smart enough to understand how important this is, so we're going to try to convince them using some semblance of propaganda or whatever to try to push them through that. I was very, very upset about that, still am, because it just seemed as though it was a slap in the face to all the parents who came forward and said, this is something that is important and we don't agree with it. So I just want you to know that that's a concern of mine. The opt-out forms, I don't recall that the bill said that you were supposed to send out opt-out forms. It said you can send out information about what opting out is about and what the policy is. I am getting now messages that the reason that people were so upset is because they read it as saying sending out opt-out forms. I heard you say that too. Am I incorrect about that, or was this because other states are doing an online access? They're giving an information about what's possible in terms of opting out, but it's not requiring people to send out opt-out forms at that particular time. Yeah. Am I missing something here?
Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, I think I need to research that as well. But my understanding was that we were expected to provide an opt-out form for districts to use with parents. So we may actually be going beyond what the legislation is directing us to do and actually providing a tool for districts to use.
We should talk about that.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
More questions? Mm-hmm. Representative McLean.
One of the smaller items that you mentioned just caught my attention, and that was the task force on the fifth year. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that I had talked to some folks from the department this summer, I think it was Derek Brown, was about the idea that we encourage good graduation rates, and it used to be that the federal government made the requirement that it had to happen in 4 years. And then the idea that there would be programs that need to be seamless, where kids get to have longer to stay to get that diploma, and then even encourage them to go on to a community college class or two for that dual enrollment kind of thing. And so there's some money issues, and there's some seamless system issues, but there also is the issue that if we're being dinged, you know, by the federal government for not having our kids graduate in 4 years, that that's an issue. So then I asked about the 200-page waiver, and I tried to work my way through that too. And my understanding was that no longer will we can count them at 4, we can count them at 5 when they do graduate. Okay, so we've got those two options. But still, when they're getting to that fifth year, somewhere, somehow, some of the schools are still be counted for that one as a dropout or a non-graduate. Do you see what I'm saying? So, like, if you don't know where they went or they're in another program. So, to me, that's contradiction of criteria. And it's causing us to have data that is, you know, basically not really giving the full picture, because we've got programs that are, you know, really are not completely integrated, or the results and the requirements for the results aren't completely integrated. So I'm just, when you have that task force, I hope that you'll address some of that, because I think we're asking folks to do things for two different reasons. We're getting credit for them on part of it, but the rest of it we're not getting credit for, it even though we're suggesting that they're improving and learning and growing by staying that extra year.
Right. So. Yeah. Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, thank you for the question. I think it's there are two key points in your comments, if I may suggest that. One is the fifth year, potentially the fifth year students, and how we actually count them, and whether they stay with the district or they go to another district. I think the task force that Senator Gelser is leading is really focused on the different types of opportunities that we afford students within the 4 year, or those that go into a fifth year in relationship to college credit. And you're absolutely right. There are some funding issues and technical issues associated with that. So that is something that's being tackled with that work group. The point that you raised relative to who we count as a graduate, and do we count them within the 4 year time frame or the 5 year time frame, and who we count as a completer, which is someone that may actually complete all of the requirements but not get a high school diploma, or somebody that would get a GED, they're considered a completer. That is part of our graduation, improving our graduation rate conversation, to look at all of those definitions, to look at all of the assumptions that we adopted as a state in 2007, and especially as we compare ourselves to other states, because we know that Texas, for example, that we get compared to, counts graduates in a very different way than Oregon does. They count completers differently than we do. So the work that Lindsay and I discussed with you will get at many of those technical issues, so we are actually comparing ourselves appropriately to other states. But most importantly, we really know where our students are going. We can track their completion and celebrate their success once they have completed and left our system.
And so, just clarification, this is an informal task force. This was not directed by a bill.
Okay.
Okay.
So, and then the last one, because of something you just said, when you're talking about, you know, comparing us between Oregon and Texas, and we're dealing there with who we count as a graduate or a completer, there's also the fact that we have two different types of tests nationwide. So when you're doing the assessments and doing some comparisons on testing, and you also have 50 states that are using different cut scores.
Yep.
And those cut scores are a big deal, because it makes a big difference on what's a 4 or 5, what, you know, on the park, and what's a 3 or 4 on the smart balance.
Yep.
And so, you know, if you're going to do some comparisons again, I want to make sure we've got criteria coordination, or at least we have a, you know, we're recognizing that we're not looking at the same thing.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, yes. Thank you. Other
thank
questions?
You.
Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. And you may not have all this information, but I want to move us to the other end of the paradigm, because I get so involved with higher ed and early learning and all these other things. But I have a question about the early learning hubs. If you could remind the committee how many early learning hubs that we have. And the other part of that is, I know in the first 2 years we only had one up and running, that was in Marion County, which is now Marion Polk. And I am wondering how many early learning hubs are up and running. And the other piece that goes with that, because of the allocations to those early learning hubs is substantial, sometimes in some of the hubs I've been informed, there's only you know, a director and maybe somebody else that's in the office, really setting the priorities and the funding for the programs out of that entire hub. So the question is, how are the early learning hubs getting their community voice and community involvement in making the decisions of what are the priorities for those individual hubs?
Chair Doherty, Representative Comp, it's a great question. So there are 16 early learning hubs in every region of the state. I would defer my answers out of caution about giving you a wrong answer about how many of those are operational to our early learning director, Megan Irwin. So I will communicate back with her and make sure she provides a report to the committee.
Thank you.
To your point, these early learning hubs should really be coordinating entities with a number of community services at the table, working on how to deliver services and deliver them in really new and innovative ways. So again, I would be happy to have a report brought back to this committee at a date certain on the status of those hubs as they're getting up and running.
Because we've had a report here on the hubs on this committee, and I know that Ms. Irwin has that information,
right,
so they can get it to you.
And a follow-up, mm-hmm. Chair Doherty, I'd ask Lindsay if I'm pretty sure the Ed Sub will meet in November, so if we could get that same report to the Ed Sub would be very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I know Washington County is very productive in working with all of these different groups,
right,
and a lot of the other counties are, and I know that she has that information. So if you can do that.
Yeah, if I may, Chair Doherty, Representative Comp, one of the other pieces that was included in the legislation, Senate Bill 213, that moved early learning hubs from demonstration sites to permanent entities requires regular reporting to the legislature and evaluation. So in addition to this report, I think there will be a continued expectation and one that we fully support and encourage that the hubs will need to demonstrate their results.
And a comment, Chair Doherty.
Mm-hmm.
This is for all of us as legislators, and that the reason why I'm here in this meeting today is the Ed Sub, as the chair recognized, is not meeting during these committee days. And so we didn't have an opportunity to request some of these same informational things that you're hearing. So logistically, we need to kind of watch our own process as we move forward with committee days.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my look to the future about how these are organized.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? Because I have one. It deals with the grant that you got for virtual schools. Is this a virtual school run by the Department of Ed, what we kind of used to call distance learning?
Chair Doherty, the virtual school, essentially it was intended to operate as a distance learning center, so to speak, and mm-hmm. it is actually funded by the legislature mm-hmm. to the Department of Education, and the department contracts with providers. Now we're contracting with school districts, ESDs, and potentially colleges and universities that have online learning programs to provide access to students.
But it's not what we would typically think of what a virtual school is.
No.
Okay.
No, it's, and we're renaming it.
Okay, but we used to call it distance learning.
Yes. Yes. It's really, it'll be an online learning platform, if you will. I just wanted to share with you that we are providing access for the first time to those courses to 138 school districts around the
Great.
State. And that is something that I'm, obviously you can see, I'm very excited about. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions for these panelists? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Next we have is our Oregon Teacher of the Year, Michael Lindblad from Gresham High School, if you'd like to come up and... Welcome to the Education Committee, practitioner of teaching children.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be here today, and I appreciate the work that you all do. I realize from a public lens, everyone reads the newspaper and expects all of you to do quite a bit, but if they actually came down here like I've had the privilege of the last couple of years and see what you actually do, they realize it's just as busy as a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate what you're doing for the state and trying to do all the different things that we're working on, as some which were articulated by the two gentlemen here before you.
Okay, thank you. And I want to make sure we introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. Chair Doherty, thank you. My name is Michael Lindblad. I teach the Gresham Bottle School District. I've been lucky enough to be the Oregon Teacher of the Year. And I wanted to kind of break my speech up into different components. I want to tell you a little bit how I arrived here at this moment in time. Today, when I came down to see Representative Peluso, I was lucky enough to walk in the room and see a bunch of the women veterans that were honored down here today at the Capitol and the signing of several bills with the governor, and I was absolutely exhilarated and inspired to see that work going on. And it reminded me of my grandfather, who was a World War II veteran. And when my parents split up in 1980, I moved in with him, and he was an immigrant. And the first thing he said was, you need to sit down at the table. There's going to be several rules here in this house. One of the rules, he said, is we're going to do homework for 2 hours every night before playtime. And after dinner, we're going to take language lessons. And he was trying to teach me both Arabic and Spanish to try and get me ready to be more multilingual in my practice. Or as a child, I didn't even really know why he was doing it at that time. Now I understand. As you know, Arabic's very difficult to read and write, so I kind of gravitated toward Spanish. And he said, back then, he said, you know, more and more people from Latin America are going to be moving here. And if you learn Spanish, it's really going to help you in the future. And all I could think back then is why he was taking my playtime away from me. But I understand completely now why he was doing that. And I use Spanish every day. It helped me meet my wife, and it helps me with my students. His other rule was that at Shaver Elementary, where I was going to school in the Park Rose School District, he wanted me to bring someone back from a different ethnicity every week for root beer floats. They had to be AMW root beer floats. And so I didn't understand why I brought back maybe 30 or 40 people in that grade school over the course of 5 years. But I understand that now, that he was really trying to develop my tolerance and help me become culturally competent. And so I'm forever grateful to him, and I thought about him today when I came down and was able to visit the veterans that came into your office, and I really applaud the work that the state is doing and all the veterans that were honored there today. So my grandfather really speaks to equity as an immigrant, and that's a major issue in our state right now. I can tell you firsthand that when I started teaching in Gresham School District in 2000, I had a 3% Latino population, and today I have a 36% Latino population, and the demographics of our state have changed so rapidly, it's been a challenge for us as a legislature and also a school district to adapt so quickly. We certainly need to make changes in this area, some of which would be providing mentorship programs for our students. Also, what Dr. Noor articulated with family engagement programs is very important on reaching out into the community. Sometimes some of our immigrants are not willing to come into the school because they're fearing of papers or their immigration status, and we have to reach out to them and bring them into the school. I also think that the Department of Education's equity unit is a microcosm of where we need to go for all the school districts. We eventually need to have our school districts have equity leaders and equity coordinators that are ensuring that this work is going on across every decision that we're making. One of the interesting things that happened to me when I was preparing to come down here today is I started thinking, okay, if I only have about 15 minutes plus questions, how on earth am I going to tell them all about education in that time? And it was actually really good because it made me boil this down to some very key points. Probably the most important point that I think impacts our graduation rate, it impacts our attendance rate, and impacts almost every facet in addition to equity, is our class sizes right now in the state of Oregon. And just to give you a little bit of personalized evidence here, I had 17 students.
And you can sit back. That's a very sensitive microphone.
Okay, so all right.
You can relax.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had 17 students
Thank
in
you.
My class in 2000, and now I have 46. And I teach six classes a day with 46 students. The class size issue, we can adapt and do all sorts of things to improve with it, but it's still a factor. There's about 26 people sitting in the room behind me, and that's what I would say would be about an average class size where you can personalize things, you can take grading home and spend time on that. Maybe in public education it should be 30, but I'm here to tell you firsthand that the class sizes we have are not going to get us to the graduation rates and the attendance rates that we want. We have 72, 73% of the students going to school. Back when we all went to school, we just went every day. because there just wasn't either else thing to do. We just expected that we would go. Today we have a lot of students that are either interpreters for their families, they have to go to work, or they just realize they can skip school and get away with it. And we have to be able to give resources to our districts to monitor the attendance, and I think that class size is absolutely vital in that conversation. And I realize that if you look at districts across the state, they all have varying class sizes, depending on if they have foundations that can raise money to get more boots on the ground, because ultimately that's what we need, is more teachers in the classroom to bring down those class size numbers. The other thing that was brought up earlier by Dr. Knorr is the amount of support services that are necessary to be a support system for those schools that have high class numbers. And I can tell you that Metropolitan Family Services, the United Way, there's so many different organizations now that are supporting the work that teachers are doing by providing after school and before school programs that provide food, they provide enrichment, and they provide credit recovery. And those are absolutely vital in terms of working and not just depending on how much money the public has or the taxpayers, but also adding in those organizations to collaborate and work together. I know that United Way in particular is trying to bring together all of the different nonprofit organizations to collaborate and make sure that we're not funding the same thing twice and that we're not having repeat services. And I believe that the legislature and United Way and other organizations are poised to be able to bring together different groups and have those conversations. And so the support services around education are vitally important as well. And the collaboration that I've seen this year as I've gone around the country and gone to Congress and gone down here to the state legislature and been lucky enough to speak at all these different engagements, I see that we have the talent in this state to be successful. And I also know there's a lot more positive things going on than we often see in the news. But one thing I've noticed with the different organizations, particularly in our state, is at times there's tension between different organizations. And I'm actually idealistic enough to think that I can bring all these people to the table and sit them down. I was with Chair Doherty the other day, going to be selecting the next Teacher of the Year, and we had all the different organizations in the state. And it's amazing how much we can learn when all the different organizations come together, whether it be the OEA, the Oregon Department of Education, the Chalkboard Project. I could go on and on with Education Northwest and Northwest Evaluation, but it's really vital that we share each other's work conditions and understand what we do and come together and sit down at the table, because ultimately we're in this for the students, and that's why I got started and that's why I'm still in there today. Even with class sizes going up, I still love the work of engaging them and inspiring those students. And I feel that if we can sit down and understand what these different organizations are doing, we can really achieve some of our goals in that regard. The last thing that I wanted to talk about is the importance of each of our organizations, okay, importance of each of our organizations to collaborate with each other. Many of you know who Mahatma Gandhi was. He's a great leader in India. And one of the best things he did is he traveled throughout the entire country, and he figured out what was going on throughout the villages, and that's what made him an effective leader. And he encouraged the people in Bombay that were just working with the English not to just work with themselves and set the policy in one place that would affect the entire nation, but he really wanted them to work together. And Fred Meyer is obviously a really successful business organization in the state. My uncle was the last person hired by Fred G. Meyer, and he drove across from the East Coast to an interview to run the marketing department. And Fred G. Meyer asked him, "What do you think about toasters?" And he told me he froze for about 5 seconds and said, "I think that we can market those." And he said, "Well, you're hired. I'm going to hire you to run the ad agency." And he said, "Well, when do I start and where do I go?" He says, "You're going to start in the stores, because you need to understand the very bottom of the organization, and then you'll start the marketing job in another year." And I feel like if we can get more of the community, more representatives into the classrooms, and we can get the classrooms to come out and go out into those different nonprofit organizations and come down to Salem, that's how we're really going to get the understanding to move this thing forward. I'm not really satisfied with our graduation rates or our attendance rates, even though I've seen the talent we have in this state. I know we can do better. And I'm certainly willing to do anything it takes, including inviting any of you into my classroom, since you have been gracious enough to come down here. And you have to forgive me for being a little bit excited, right? I'm just a very excited person about education. I'm used to leaning forward. Actually, I'm used to actually standing up when I speak, not sitting down. So that, to me, is vital, the lesson from Gandhi and Fred G. Meyer, that we have to exchange and know each other's organizations, get out and see those things, and then sit down at the table together to figure out what's best for students, to raise Oregon's achievement and maximize our talent, because I know that we can do this, and I'm willing to do it, and I know that you are too. So I could go on forever. I usually speak for an hour at a time, but I really wanted to open it up for questions, because just like all the things I was excited about when I came down here today, I know that you have a lot of questions about schools and about what's going on inside the classroom and about different initiatives that are going on and what happens to the bills and what's going on in the Department of Education and things like that. So thank you very much for having me here, and I want to move the state forward and make us maximize our talents.
Hey, thank you very much. We're very proud of having you as a good reflection of the teachers of the state of Oregon. Do we have any questions of Mr. Lindblad? Representative Reardon.
Well, thank you. I'm very honored to have you here. I appreciate it. You know, there's probably a million questions we could ask you, and would love to spend hours picking your brain, but I have one. It's, would you talk a little bit about the importance of the relevance of the subject or the relevance of the teaching to the students and how that plays into your work, or if it does?
Absolutely. So, Chair Doherty and Representative Reardon, thank you for the question. Relevance is a very important factor when you're teaching students, and probably the most important thing as you begin the school year is to find out the background of all your students. Where do they come from? And I'm going to put a little equity lens on this. One of the things we did in the Gresham-Barlow School District in 2008 is we brought student empowerment groups together and sat them in classrooms with teachers they felt comfortable with, and they started actually telling us about our curriculum. And we found out that a lot of students did not feel represented in our curriculum, particularly Native American, African American, and Latino students talked about that they felt like they were always presented in terms of being colonized or in terms of being in conquest as opposed to achievements and heroes. So I think relevance is incredibly important, whether you're talking about literacy and ELA and MLA and smarter balance, or whether you're just talking about why are we going over this history or social studies, because I think in every single lesson across every class there should be a skill preparation for life. Not just something we're learning in the schoolhouse, but something that where these students can go on and be successful in our state in college or also in the business world, writing, reading, and communicating. A lot of our students today, Representative Reardon, are very good with cell phones. Very good with cell phones.
We want to hear your words.
And very good with social media, but sometimes they have a difficulty communicating eye to eye. As you can tell, I like to do, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I think that the relevance would be skill sets to prepare them in any part of the world, whether they're going on to college and whether they're going on to the business world. And in addition, making sure that we have culturally relevant curriculum to modify to our changing demographic in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Peluso from Gresham.
Yes, from Gresham. For the great city of Gresham. Not a question, just a shout out. I can't tell you how I have known Mr. Lindblad for at least 10 years mm-hmm. In our district. He is truly a leader. He is a motivator of students in a way that is very difficult to define. He allows them to set the stage, mm-hmm. just as he talked about, you know, learning about backgrounds and diversity and those sorts of things. So it's just, it is an honor to have him here. It is an honor that he is from Gresham, home of the Gresham Gophers. So if any teacher can tolerate that title for their entire career, there's something right there.
Good play.
He's an avid baseball fan and past player, family guy, and he taught my daughter, who turned her into a great success. So I appreciate that as well. But again, if I believe Mike represents so many of our teachers. I mean, we're blessed to have him in our district, but I think we need to see that he is setting the example of how good our teachers are everywhere throughout our state, and we cannot minimize that. And as we still struggle again with the issues that he talked about, classroom sizes, attendance, we got to keep our teachers motivated and happy, and so that we get our kids well educated. And again, this is the man that has set the bar very high, and I'm very proud to have him here today with me.
Well, thank you, Representative Peluso. I want to also say that when I had her daughter in class, she was an amazing student. Actually brought her guitar in one day and wrote an entire lesson on Native Americans and how they engage the environment. At that time, I didn't think I'd have any more children. I had three daughters, and just a few years ago, my wife and I went to Hawaii, and we got back, and she said, "I need to talk to you." At that point in time, she took me to my favorite restaurant, and then I was really worried, and she said, "I'm pregnant." And I won't tell you what was going through my mind, but I can tell you that it was even more amazing when I found out we were going to have twins. So I now have twin boys at home, and all my daughters have gone through Oregon schools. I plan on my twins to go through Oregon schools and hopefully be in a dual immersion program if possible, because we speak Spanish, English, Spanglish, and some type of gaggle between twins in my house. And I'm really excited for that. I'm teaching them how to read and not eat all the books.
Yes. We had a little conversation. They just eat up the reading, literally. Well, I'd like to, any other questions, comments? Mr. Barreto.
Yeah, I'd like to ask one. Thank you. How many years have you been teaching?
I have been teaching, Representative Barreto, thank you for the question, Representative Doherty, Chair Doherty. I've been teaching for 19 years, and I'm just now coming up on my 20th year. I started out, first 3 years I taught were at Lake Ridge High School, and then to improve my Spanish and cultural competency, I went and lived in Peru for a year to pick up Spanish and came back and identified the Gresham Barlow School District as a place where I could really maximize my skill sets.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for your service. And your immersion into the Spanish language, you know, is a little different, I think, than what they do today. But the way we are dealing with the LL in the schools, you know, in your opinion, is it, and just the increase in Hispanic students that you mentioned since you started, do you have an opinion on the way we're doing it and if there was a better system?
You know, I think the way we're handling ELL is pretty good for the most part. I think that when you deal with that set of students, you have to have a huge support system to build self-esteem. One of the things that we've realized is when our principal did this survey, Carol Dabrill, many years ago, probably when Representative Peluso's daughter was in school, she put up a piece of paper all around the room in the gym and made every teacher go in and sign the name next to the student if they knew him. Well, by golly, in a school of 1,700 students, there were 76 students that no one signed their name next to. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the studies indicate that those students will come to school when they have a mentor that identifies with them. Mm-hmm. I think the PSYOP research tells us we have to be very specific with language we're doing with our EL students and have vocabulary and content terms available every single day. But the most important thing is we have to keep our expectations high. And even though we have to keep the support up, the expectations on these students have to be high. I can tell you, just 3 weeks ago, my EL class with students from 17 countries, our first homework assignment, we brought in only 32% of us brought that homework assignment in. And if you want to say, well, I don't know if I can do it as a teacher, I'm not sure I can get that assignment up, well, I pretty much communicated to them, and I won't share with you today exactly what I said. I said, listen, I know you're better than this, and I know that your parents have gone to school systems all over the world, and they've sacrificed a lot to get you into this system to have this opportunity, and I want you to honor that opportunity. And if we all don't bring our homework tomorrow, don't be surprised if we have homework for 2 months straight. Now, a lot of teachers in those EL classes sometimes aren't going to be as hard on those students, but I feel like if I set the expectations up on a mountain, they will come if they know that I care about them and love them and care about them. And by the way, 97% of the students brought their homework in the very next day. So I would say we have to keep the expectations high, and the wraparound support services have to be there, not just in class, but also after school and before school, and having summer academies and going into the middle schools and doing a lot of that family engagement work to not just engage the EL students, but engage their families. When my wife came into the country, the Park Grove School District actually had two parent nights a week to come down and provide language lessons, health care, and all sorts of wraparound services to do that. So I think that's an excellent question because it's a microcosm of where we have to go as a state.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? And I just kind of like to close. You know, we have about not quite half of us were all high school teachers and understand what you know, we're going through every day. But the one thing about education, and I think you're a very good representative of this, personally, I've done some things that people go, wow, you've been a state representative, or wow, you were an OEA UNISERV consultant, or wow, you were this. But the best thing I've ever done and the most rewarding thing I've ever done was be a high school teacher. And, you know, you think about that, and you think about how much more you could make doing something else, or how you wouldn't have to work so hard and so many hours doing something else because it's not just 8 to 5. And I'm just pleased that you are representing the teachers in not only Oregon, but also just teaching as a profession because it is the best profession in the world. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Chair.
Yes.
Permission to applaud.
Yes, permission to applaud. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. Speaking of different languages, the next group we have is an informational meeting on the dual language immersion program. Folks from Salem Elementary. So we have Martha Martinez, Neil Anderson, Krista Chapman, and Teresa Talento. If you all, do you all want to come up at the same time, or?
It may make more sense to do ODE first.
Okay, we'll do ODE, and then we'll have you folks come up in Salem. How's that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you very
One part of Salem for the other part of Salem.
You guys should still be here. I'm trying to figure out this reaches. Okay.
And the worst part about teaching is AV stuff. So, we understand.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is Martha Martinez, and I am with the Education Equity Unit at the Oregon Department of Education. And I feel like this was teed up so nicely for me with the previous teacher, and what an honor to have then the Oregon Teacher of the Year tee up not only your unit, but the work that you do in the unit. So thank you, Mr. Lindbott, for that. Yeah. And I am representing the Oregon Department of Education in the work that we're doing on related to dual language programs, but I certainly am not the only person that's working on this, and I really want to thank the Assistant Superintendent David Bautista for making this a priority for the department, and I feel very honored that I've been able to move forward with it. My background, actually, I got my PhD from the University of Oregon, and my dissertation had to do with two-way immersion programs and segregation issues. And so I, when this opportunity presented itself to lead a dual language grant last biennium, I jumped at the chance and feel, as I said, very fortunate to have arrived at the department at the time that I did and be able to do the work that I am doing now there. What I'm going to provide you with is an overview of the types of dual language programs. There's a lot of labels that are out there that don't necessarily mean the same thing, and there isn't necessarily research to support every single model. And so what I want to talk about are the different types, and then I also want to give you a little bit of research, a summary of the research on student outcomes, and then talk about some related student initiatives, or state initiatives, I should say. So this is an umbrella that you may see when you look at dual language programs. It comes up, and it's one that I believe Elizabeth Howard may have crafted. Let me see. I think I've got this citation here. Yeah, Howard, Olagi, and Rogers. Elizabeth Howard is a professor. I think she's at the University of Connecticut, and she's affiliated with the Center for Applied Linguistics and is an expert on these programs. And as the research base was building on both two-way immersion and long-term dual language programs that are developmental programs, there was a lot more work to do that was done around what are the specific aspects of the program that are most indicative of or most contributing to the effectiveness of these programs. And so what we have tried to highlight actually at the Oregon Department of Education too is the importance of model type and the importance of understanding what that model is across the state and then capturing that in our data systems. So the four main types of dual language programs that I want to talk to you today are the long-term dual language programs that have these labels: developmental bilingual, two-way immersion, heritage language, and world language immersion. The similarities between these programs are, in large part, the instruction is provided in a language other than English. So in some cases, it's exclusively provided in that partner language. In other cases, it's shared. And the percentage really varies. These are long-term programs. They begin in kindergarten, and they go at least through elementary school. And oftentimes, more oftentimes, now we're seeing these programs reach through high school. The goals are that students are bilingual. They be at exit from the program. Some of the programs emphasize biliteracy as well. Some emphasize cross-cultural awareness and or cultural competency. And again, that varies depending on the way in which the program is implemented and what the emphasis of that particular school or district is. Some of the major differences is that the target students for each of these programs are different, and the amount of instruction in English and the partner language really varies. And I can't really differentiate those consistently by model type in terms of the amount of instruction. Theoretically, for world language immersion programs, what you would see is that the partner language is used 100% of the time, but it really does vary depending on the way in which it's implemented at the school. So in terms of student types, however, developmental bilingual programs target primarily, if not exclusively, English learners. And they target ones, or the ones that are in these programs when you have a developmental bilingual program, so they're from the same language group. So the most common of the developmental bilingual programs and the two-way immersion programs are Spanish programs, and that's a reflection of our EL population. The majority of our EL population, as you all are probably intimately aware, are Spanish speakers, with close to probably 50%, both nationally and then within the state. Two-way immersion programs target both English learners and native English speakers, and they try and bring approximately a 50-50. Ideally, theoretically, the theoretical ideal is a 50-50 split. And I've even had some folks say, well, is that really the theoretical ideal? So based upon the research that I have done, yeah, ideally 50-50 split in this model, with the EL population, again, being of a single language group. And then you have native English speakers that are their peers in this model. The kind of power of this model and a major focus of this model is that each of these language groups serves as a language model for the other one. And so that's why the 50-50 split, or no less than one-third of any one language group, is really stressed in that model. Heritage language programs they tend to, again, include English learners of a single language background, but actually this really, the population is heritage language speakers. So sometimes you have students in there that English is their native language, but they have a heritage language that either is still dominant in their background, or it may have actually been lost altogether. So you'll see these programs actually in New Mexico more because there are quite a few Native American heritage language programs where they're attempting to recapture the program. And then world language immersion programs are the programs that really have targeted native English speaker and English speakers and provide them with this immersion experience. So in terms of the research on student outcomes, the focus of the research I'm going to be sharing with you is a large focus of it is on two-way immersion programs. There's kind of a growing body of research to support these. However, there is also research to support long-term dual language programs that have the developmental bilingual or maintenance bilingual label as well. This research base has been building for many, many years now, and it really has focused on the research on these particular programs on their effectiveness for improving outcomes for English learners and also for closing achievement gaps between English learners and non-English learners. The research also, though, does show that there are positive outcomes for native English speakers within these programs. And actually, one of the reasons why two-way immersion programs have started to proliferate and some of the world language immersion programs have morphed is because of the power of that other language model. And the fact that they were seeing in the research based on world language immersion programs a plateauing of students at a certain level and not progressing beyond that. And it really helped them when they had peers in the in their classrooms then that spoke their target language, basically, on a regular basis. So in terms of the research findings, what you see in the literature base is that students from both language groups in two-way immersion programs achieve at levels comparable to or higher than their peers in English-only programs on standardized assessments in both reading and math. The achievement gaps between English learners in two-way immersion and their native English peers in two-way immersion are closed. Eventually, this doesn't happen within the first few years. The research will show that it happens typically in late middle school and in high school. These results have been replicated with programs that teach us a variety of languages. So we're not just talking about Spanish dual language immersion programs, but also Chinese programs, programs that focus on Chinese, Korean, and French as the partner language. They enroll students of varying socioeconomic status. So these aren't programs that only are targeting students that are well off. These include students actually, and in fact, oftentimes what you will see with two-way immersion programs is a dichotomy of students that are served. And you'll see students that are the Spanish-speaking students being very low income, and then students that are English speakers tending not to be. So that's actually been a part of what the research base has highlighted and talked about the needs to address those disparities head on. These outcomes, as I mentioned before, they're typically not evident until upper elementary grades. I said middle school before. That's when the initial outcomes happen, are in upper elementary grades where you start seeing positive outcomes, but the gaps start closing really in middle school and high school. In terms of the high school outcomes, two-way immersion students achieve at or above grade level in math. Two-way immersion students tend to enroll in higher level math courses than their non-two-way immersion peers, and more two-way immersion students than non-two-way immersion students in this particular district under study pass the high school exit exam. And then of those students then that were surveyed, more of the two-way immersion students than not indicated they wanted to attend a four-year college after high school, and they believe that getting good grades is important, and they plan not to drop out of school. So as a result of the research really that points to the effectiveness of this program, there was a dual language initiative that was launched in the last biennium. We funded programs in Portland, Hood River, Newburgh, Springfield, Ontario, Nyssa, Central Point, and do I have Springfield down there twice? And Springfield, I do. Sorry about that. We are launching a K-12 Biliteracy Pathways grant this biennium, which is focused more on established programs and on the creation or further development or shoring up of K-12 Biliteracy Pathways. We are likely to fund up to five grant sites with this next iteration. The focus on established programs is intentional. In the launching of the first dual language program grant, most of the programs that were funded were new programs, and some were brand spanking new. And we had like three new ones, and we had three that were only served at the very early primary grades. We only had one established program. And there is a considerable amount of interest then, of course, by the legislature and those that provided the funding for this for outcomes. And these programs don't show outcomes at startup. No program actually shows outcomes at startup. However, they do show outcomes in an established program after all the kinks have been worked out and in the upper elementary grades, as I mentioned before. So we wanted to include more established programs, and we also crafted the RFP in the previous round in a way that kind of disadvantaged established programs in terms of the scoring. So that's in some way, this next iteration is in some ways to rectify that. We also have a state seal of biliteracy. It was in its pilot year last year. We awarded 423 graduating seniors with a state seal of biliteracy, and we are expecting them to formally adopt criteria on the state seal of biliteracy this year.
So it's like a certification that the students have?
Yes, achieved a certain level then. And a colleague of mine, who's no longer at the department, led that work, but worked with stakeholders across the state and districts that actually had started doing state seals, their own district seals of biliteracy, to then figure out what we could adopt at the state level. Oregon is not unique in moving forward with a state seal. So you'll see from this map, which is from Californians Together, that 9 states have already approved seals, and 15 states, which is including Oregon, are in the early stages of development. So that's my presentation for you. I wanted to provide you with some resources so that you know where I got the research that's mentioned here. We are very fortunate in the last grant to have had national experts that were consultants, including Dr. Lindholm Leary, who is a national expert on two-way immersion research. And so we're hopeful that we'll be able to identify some national experts to help us on the next grant as well.
Okay, so,
thank you.
Any questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. One of the languages that was not mentioned that has a long term in Portland is the Japanese immersion program. Is that included in the study, or just because it is unique? I guess it's unique at this particular point that it's not part of this effort.
So the research that I quoted here are of programs that exist across the United States. And the Korean program actually is an LA program. And I believe the Chinese program may be as well, or at least it was a California program. The research that has been done in Oregon, actually, on these programs has been on Spanish programs.
Sure.
So it's not to say that there isn't research on Japanese immersion programs. I just don't have it referenced here.
The reason, may I follow up? Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is that because of the iconography, the origin of some of the language, the similarities in terms of Spanish versus English, or with English, versus Chinese or Korean or Japanese or Arabic. Those programs exist, but I'm just curious whether how well they are adopted, and how well they do over time.
Yeah, so I can't quote at this time, you know, what the results have been with respect to Japanese programs, but we do have research that shows that students are becoming biliterate in Korean and Chinese programs. And those are students that aren't, some of whom are heritage speakers, but others are not. And in fact, we have documentation across these programs that they serve a wide variety of not just language backgrounds, but racial and ethnic backgrounds, that these students are able to acquire a second language in a variety of different languages. So I'll have to get back to you about the Japanese, about research on Japanese immersion programs.
And one more follow-up. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that we've discovered in looking at the Japanese program and the Chinese program in the Portland schools was that those students also had a greater ability in math and a number of other issues because they had what appeared to be a range of brain cell pathways that were now created that allowed for some symbolic use of language and other issues. And I wondered that tying those together might help. It's not just a matter of learning another language. It also seems to be providing other possibilities for students.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is the cognitive research that has been done on learning another language and about how it just creates a smarter brain. And so that's been another reason why these programs have, I didn't include the map that shows how these programs have exploded over the years. And it's a reflection, too, of the research that's been done on the brain and what learning a second language does, in the same way that learning music, you know, does. It just does something different to the brain and allows you to think in different ways. It allows you to multitask in ways that aren't evident in monolingual speakers. So there definitely is research to support that, the benefits beyond speaking the language.
Okay, any other questions? Quickly, please.
The one question I had was, you made a mention about established schools and non-established schools, and then you connected that to the grant process for the next time. Will you please clear that up?
Sure. So this next grant prioritizes established programs, and so I've gotten actually a number of questions from school districts across the state that said, you know, if we don't have a program K-5, can we still apply? And what the answer I've provided them is, yes, you can still apply, but the way in which we've crafted the scoring rubric is established programs, at least K-5, will be rated higher. And so, again, the intent behind that is we had one established program in the last iteration of the grant, and this is a different kind of grant, too. The focus of this one is on the pathway. It's not just the creation of new programs that are beneficial, definitely beneficial to students, but how do we support, then, Oregon's interest in biliteracy for students through K-12? I also, I guess, want to put the caveat out there, too. These are really difficult programs to launch and to sustain, to grow and sustain. And so I think eventually our country will move in this direction and this is the way we'll educate people. But as of right now, we don't have the bilingual teaching capacity to support lots and lots of new programs. We barely can support the ones that are existing now, and I've been working for the past 2 years with TSBC to try and figure out how we can be better about identifying highly qualified biliterate individuals. And so that is a major reason why it's been difficult to launch new programs and even to sustain existing ones.
Because I know I've had teachers, who a friend of mine, who are fluent in, for example, Spanish, but it was different teaching bilingual classes than being fluent in Spanish. And so to have an ESL or ELL teacher and a dual language teacher sometimes took different skills. So, yeah. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Salem Group, the other part of Salem Group.
Is that Salem, Massachusetts, then?
Huh?
Yeah. The other Salem?
No. The people down on State Street.
I don't think how smart I would have been.
If you want to make sure that you all, when you speak, identify yourself for the record, please. Okay, thank you. Yeah, do we? Do you guys need the presentation to start, or should we?
No, I definitely can start. My name is Neil Anderson. I'm the Director of Instructional Services for the Salem Kaiser School District. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Frederick, Vice Chair Springer, it's a true honor and privilege to be with you today. I want to frame up the Salem Kaiser School District for you, and then I'm going to turn it over to my three colleagues here that will be able to describe to you more fully what our bilingual programs are within the Salem Kaiser School District. So, you are sitting in the second largest school district in the state of Oregon, with now close to 41,500 students within our boundary system. We have 64 schools, and of those 64 schools, we have 44 elementary schools, of which 23 of them have some form of bilingual education program within them. And we have four bilingual pathways at the secondary schools as well. to properly ensure a K-5 model, and this is somewhat what Martha was just speaking about, we have an exciting opportunity in front of us in the state, the growth of an understanding of the importance of bilingual education. However, when you have that understanding, the excitement also comes with challenges, and one of them is staffing. Case in point, Salem-Keizer alone would need 79 teachers currently right now just at the elementary school level to make our bilingual programs that we do have whole. And we filled those spots currently with highly endorsed and highly trained ESOL teachers, but it still creates an opportunity for us and a challenge for us when we understand and believe in bilingual education for our students in Salem-Keizer and around the state. And so I'm going to turn it over now to my three colleagues, and they're going to be able to outline for you our bilingual programs within the Salem-Keizer. I know at the end they'll be able to answer any questions that you have, and I'd like to introduce them to you. To my immediate right is Chrissy Chapman. She is Federal Programs Coordinator focusing on elementary English language acquisition and bilingual programs for our school district. And to her right is Brad Capener. He is also a Federal Programs Coordinator, and he focuses at the secondary level for English language acquisition and bilingual programs. And at the end is Ms. Teresa Tolento. She is the current principal at Grant Elementary, and interestingly enough, is one of the longest standing and serving bilingual programs in the state of Oregon. And so these three will be able to describe to you our programs and the services that we provide and also answer any questions. At this time, I'm going to slide my chair back because I think the focus should be provided to these three outstanding individuals.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And make sure, even though he did a wonderful job of introducing you, for the record, you need to reintroduce yourself. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Chrissy Chapman. I am the Elementary Federal Programs Coordinator for Salem-Keizer Public Schools. So Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Springer, and Vice Chair Frederick, thank you for having us today. To start our presentation, I wanted to share with you the different program models that we have in the state of Oregon. And Martha talked about kind of the umbrella of different bilingual programs that that are recognized throughout the nation. And then Oregon has identified which ones we can actually choose from to use in our schools. And so we'll talk about the state, and then later we'll talk about what we use here in Salem-Keizer Public Schools. So the first one that is up there is a two-way immersion program, which Martha did talk about a little bit. This is the purpose of it is to provide proficiency in both languages. So you want students to be bilingual, biliterate, bicultural, and in doing that, you have a group of ideally half English-speaking, half students of a native speakers of the other language. Here in Salem, we have Spanish is the other language that we provide our two-way immersion programs in. And these programs typically last through elementary school, if not through high school. So ideally, they do go all the way from pre-K or kindergarten through 12th grade. And there, you'll hear two different types of models that are talked about, a 90-10 versus a 50-50. And a 90-10 is when early on in kindergarten, first, second grade, about 90% of the instruction is in Spanish. And then as you go through, it ends up being around fourth or fifth grade, a 50-50 model where 50% of your instruction is in your target language, which in this case is Spanish, and the other 50% would be in English. So that would be a 90-10 model where you have much more of the native target language early on than going into a 50-50 model. There are other programs that are just a 50-50 model from kindergarten on. So half of your instruction is in English, half is in Spanish. The main difference between the two is a 90-10 model, you're having sequential literacy instruction. So you start just with your target language literacy instruction. And so, for example, in Spanish, all of your literacy instruction would be in Spanish early on. Then later you would add in English literacy. Where in a 50-50 model, it's simultaneous. So you're teaching your literacy in both languages at the same time. The next one is developmental bilingual. And this one, you also want to develop proficiency in both languages. And the goal is that students are bilingual and biliterate. This one typically lasts through elementary as well, if not through high school. And the main difference is this is typically just for English learners. So you don't have the mix of English students, native English speakers with your target language students. So it's just for your English learners. And then transitional bilingual programs. The purpose of this is to transition students into an English-only setting. So these are typically only done for a few years. So maybe a K-2 program or a K-3 program, and then in third or fourth grade, students would transition into an English-only classroom. And these, again, are for English learners. There typically are not any native English-speaking students in these classes. And the last one would be other bilingual programs the state does approve. one being heritage language that Martha talked about, where you're trying to bring back a language that perhaps has been lost for a student, such as Native American languages or Hawaiian languages. And so so those are the four program models that are predominant in the state. And I do have a handout of the that summarizes them from the Department of Ed, if you would like to have that.
You want to give them to Shelley. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Brad Capener. I'm the ESOL Federal Programs Coordinator for Salem-Keizer for secondary schools and the Migrant Coordinator, and coordinate the Dual Language Program for secondary schools. In this slide, we wanted to take a few minutes and just talk about some of the benefits. Teresa and I were going to kind of tandem this a little bit, but talk about some of the benefits of the bilingual programs and kind of from our lens. What we see, and also what the research bears out. So the first one is, actually I'm going to go down to prepare students to be global citizens, expands educational and professional prospects. And while English is a global language and important to know, it's been estimated that there are more second language speakers of English around the world than native speakers. And so knowing English is very important, but also it's important to communicate in Spanish, Arabic, Chinese, and as well as other languages. So students who leave school competent in languages other than English will have a competitive edge in the global marketplace and benefit Oregon's economy as businesses are looking for candidates proficient in two languages. And I took a group of students last year to an education fair down in Portland. I took 40 migrant students. And every major corp, there's tons of corporations and businesses there recruiting and high school youth. And every single one of them were desiring and looking for people who spoke both languages. So, and we'll get to this when we talk about the biliteracy seal, but being able to have a core group of students who are speaking, writing, listening to a high degree in two languages, we feel is a benefit to our state and to our country as well. Teresa.
For the record, I'm Teresa Tolento, the principal at Grant Community School. So Representative Doherty and Vice Chair Springer and Vice Chair Frederick, thank you for having us. It's a privilege for me to be here and be able to support the program at my school and share some of the learnings that we've made along the way and hopefully gather some of your support for our programs. I'm going to talk about outcomes in a dual language settings. My school is a two-way immersion program, which means there are students from both learning Spanish and also students learning English. There's a multitude of research, and most recently in the East Coast with the outcomes in later years for students who are in dual language programs. Some of that research is being written as we speak. We had the privilege of having Wayne Thomas and Virginia Collier at our school last school year, and they spoke about engagement and amazing results that a group of underperforming students in the Carolinas are doing, particularly African-American students in dual language programs, and I would be very happy to share that in the future when it is published. And it goes on to demonstrate how dual language is a world-class education for not only English language learners, but also any student, really. And what I'm most passionate about with this program is that it was created to support English language learners and give access to a rigorous education. And so I'm going to use very simple terms to explain this. There's among educators still some confusion between understanding the difference between conceptual knowledge and language knowledge. And let's say, again, in very simple terms, the understanding of what an apple is is the taste, the shape, and the fact that it is a fruit, is universal. However, the code used to describe that apple in Spanish is manzana, in French is pomme, and in English is apple. And so does it mean that one person knows that concept better than the other, but rather that there's a different code? And so the reason I'm using illustrating this is to capitalize on what happens when early learners enter our school district and have only one code or a very limited second code in English. The way that we learn is by making connections to what we already know. And for this reason, Spanish instruction, especially in the early years, is essential to give access to rigorous education. Our early learners who don't know English will learn English better if they are given native language instruction, and we have data to support that that we will share with you.
Another benefit is the fact that it builds community, and what we see in classrooms is this positive interdependence among peers and between teachers and students. And students are working on projects, helping each other with their languages. What we see is there's no dominant language in the classroom. And as a result, a very positive, respectful classroom community is built where, native English speakers and English learners, or English as a second language, are working together on projects and helping each other with their languages. And just to add, finish to that, is the fact that this communication skills builds cultural awareness and helps the communication piece.
So here we have a couple of examples of some research that has been done in the field of bilingual education. The first graph up there is by Alana Omansky, who is at the University of Oregon now, and Sean Reardon, and this. This project was a 12-year look at longitudinal data in a school in California, or a district in California, excuse me. And it looked at over 50,000, the district had over 50,000 students, and the actual research project looked at over 5,000 students, about 5,400. And it looked at students who entered the district in kindergarten and began their programs. And they had four different programs within their district. There was an English immersion, which was students entered into strictly an English classroom, no bilingual education. They had a transitional program, which students had access to native language instruction through second or third grade and then went into an English-only classroom. They had maintenance bilingual, which students had access to bilingual education through fifth grade, and then a dual language immersion program, which they had bilingual education through 12th grade. And so the graph that's up there shows you the results that students had on it's the California assessment, their state assessment for language arts that they had in 2012 when the study was completed. That this is the percentage of students that met the language arts criteria for specific grade levels. And so if you look at it, early on, it looks as if the English immersion students, which is the solid line, outperformed their peers who were in bilingual programs. But as you go through and you get to 11th, 12th grade, the solid line is now at the very bottom, and those students were performing the worst out of the four different groups of students. And the students who were in the dual program that goes through 12th grade were performing at the highest level. And so, and then below that was the maintenance, which were students who had it through fifth grade, and then below that would be the students who had it through second or third grade. So this demonstrates the positive outcomes for our students who are in dual language programs long term versus only looking at the results in elementary school, which can be skewed because they haven't had the chance to acquire the language yet in order to be able to demonstrate their learning, much like Teresa was explaining, that they don't quite have the code yet to perform in the language arts testing. Then the one on the right is a very famous graph by Thomas and Collier, who visited Grant this past year, Wayne Thomas and Virginia Collier. And they did their research with over 42,000 students, and they looked at students in all different types of programs. I know that you can't read all of those, but the ones that are down at the bottom, kind of the pink and the red lines, are students who were in English-only programs, or maybe they were in a newcomer program for 1 year and then went into a mainstream classroom. And as it goes up, it's different types of bilingual programs, the top one being the green with the most success being your two-way immersion program, which has half English-speaking, half students of another language, typically Spanish in this area. And so that's a graph that is referenced quite regularly. This one looked at the academic achievement of students in those programs, and so it's clear that the students in the two-way program were the most successful academically overall. And then just to give you some references to what we have in Salem, on our next slide we have outlined the different program models that we have here in Salem-Keizer Public Schools. We have a two-way immersion program, and this is a pre-K-12 program. We have it at three of our elementary schools. And so I'll talk about the elementary piece, and Brad will talk about the secondary piece. So we have it in three of our elementary schools, and then it goes through 12th grade. And there are 540 students total enrolled in this program in our district, pre-K, well, K-12. That doesn't take into account our preschool students. And we try to have a good 50-50 balance of our students who are 50% English-speaking, 50% Spanish-speaking. And we have a 90-10 model so that early on, 90% of the instruction is in Spanish. And by fourth or fifth grade, it's a 50-50 split. And I'll let Brad talk about what it looks like for secondary, and then we'll explain the transitional bilingual program.
So we have two middle school programs, two high school programs. The idea at both at the secondary level is that students speak Spanish for a couple periods of their day throughout the year. What we want to do is be able to give them exposure to different kinds of academic classes that are different each time. So it's not the same, it's not like history every year, because there's the academic language is also very different in different subject areas. So to enrich in their experience, they'll have a constant language class, but then they'll also have different content area classes. So one year or one semester it's science, the next it might be social science, and then mathematics and so forth. So half of their day or part of their day is in Spanish throughout the 12th grade.
And as Neil mentioned at the beginning, this is one of the longest standing bilingual programs in the state. The school that Teresa's at, Grant, is one of the schools involved in our two-way program. The other program that we have is a transitional bilingual. We have worked with the University of Colorado and Dr. Kathy Escamilla we worked with them for about 6 years, and this is the seventh year that we have implemented their program that's called Literacy Squared. It's really an approach to bilingual education, but it is a transitional bilingual program. It is actually supposed to be a maintenance bilingual where it goes through fifth grade, but unfortunately, as Martha was saying, we have a huge teacher shortage, and we do not have enough bilingual teachers to fill this program. And as Neil mentioned, we have 79 bilingual teachers that we would need in order to be able to fully staff these programs. So in many of our schools, we only are able to offer a bilingual program through second grade, through third grade, through fourth grade, where ideally at all 20 of these schools, it would be through fifth grade. And so if I could magically come up with 50 bilingual teachers, we would have these programs through fifth grade, which as you saw on the previous slides, have much better outcomes than students who do only get it through second or third grade. And then the Literacy Squared program, or the transitional bilingual, is a program that's just for our English learners. And so it's students who come with a significant background in Spanish that go into these classrooms. And we currently have 3,350 students who are enrolled in our transitional bilingual program. And some of these students, depending on where they go to middle and high school, can feed into the dual language program in secondary. And so those students then have the opportunity to have a K-12 program. But we can't offer it at all of middle and high school, unfortunately, just because of staffing and requirements for endorsements that we'll explain here in a minute.
I'd like to explain our assessment results comparing English language learners in the transitional bilingual model that Chrissy explained in comparison to all students in Oregon, all students in our district, and then also all ELL students in Oregon and all ELL students in our district. You will see third, fourth, and fifth because those are the assessment years. And so as you will notice in third grade, the first graph is all students in Oregon, the second one is all all students in Salem Kaiser and their achievement. And then the next three are the bars that compare our limited English proficient students, or ELL. The middle bar is the Oregon limited English proficient students. The second one is Salem Kaiser, and then the last one are the students in the program, the transitional program. And to back up some of the information that Martha shared with us earlier, we see better outcomes the more years students are in the program, and we can see that as well here with the greater difference in fifth grade of almost 100% difference in comparison to the students that were not in that program. Still below the state average with all students, but comparing English language learners, the results are significantly better for students who have received early literacy in their native language. The second chart looks at students who, in their performance on the English language acquisition exam, or ELPA, that measures their English competency. And so in order for an English language learner to exit English language learner status and be considered proficient in English, they would need to score a 5. If we see here a progression of how many students scored a 5 in the 2008 and 9 school year, the year before we had these bilingual programs implemented, and how they gradually increased. And so this is looking at only 4th and 5th grade students in the year 2012 and 13, that increased to 13% of our students attaining proficiency in 4th and 5th. And then in the year 2013-14, 17% of our students attaining English language proficiency in 4th and 5th. And figures for last year are still difficult for us to get, because we just transitioned into a new student information system. But at least at my school, the increase was twofold. We went from 3% in fifth grade to 17% attaining proficiency just in fifth grade. And then combined with fourth and fifth, we were over 25%. But district-wide, we see here the growth, the combined percentage points of over 56% when comparing to the year when we did not have Spanish literacy. And so to illustrate the point as to why, it's, again, when students have access to rigorous literacy and are able to comprehend and learn to read and write in one language, those skills transfer more easily into the second language. And we also have programs to support our teachers in how to facilitate that transfer. But without conceptual understanding, there's not much to transfer.
So I'm really excited about this next slide, the seal of biliteracy. Martha went over what that was, so I won't repeat what she said and talk about the overview of it. But just from a historical standpoint, I've worked with my colleagues in other districts around the state of Oregon, and also the university system prior to the seal work being done at ODE. And the whole idea of saying, hey, is there a way we can come together with a common definition of what it means to have rigor and to be able to leave high school with a seal of biliteracy on your diploma? Because until there's a seal, it can look different at Hillsborough than it does in Salem, and one might be more rigorous than the other. So what we wanted to do was give students the advantage in the workforce, and for employers to know, and for colleges to know, that, hey, these kids went through a certain rigorous study, course of study, or attained through examination a level of competency. And so I really applaud ODE and the Equity Unit for giving us some work in this regard. Last year, we gave 25 seals of biliteracy in Salem-Keizer. And this is kind of work that's going to exponentially grow as people find out about it, and you know, it's not just for kids who are going through a K-12 program, but anyone who can have the ability to show competency in both languages to a high degree. So the AP language exam or another IB exam sort of thing. So we are we feel that we're on a really great track for helping our students, and we are continuing the discussion with our higher ed colleagues as to what this might mean for students coming out with the seal, and so we're excited. Thank you.
So for our last slide, we wanted to share with you some of the barriers that we come across as a school district trying to provide these programs for our students. As you saw, we have nearly 4,000 students of our 7,000 English learners that are in bilingual programs in Salem-Keizer. But this isn't done easily. It's very challenging to have a bilingual program. We know that it's the right work, and we spend a lot of time and a lot of resources and a lot of effort to make sure that we can provide these programs for our students and at a high quality. And so some of the barriers that we do have in running these programs is the teacher shortage. That is probably the number one thing that holds us back from providing the programs that we really want to provide, which would be at least a K-5 program for all kids, if not a K-12 program. As we mentioned, we have at least 70 positions that we would have to fill in order to have these programs fully staffed. And also at the secondary level, there is an issue of endorsements.
Yeah, so not only do we have a shortage of teachers, but in secondary, you need to also have the endorsement in science. You need to be able to teach science to a high degree and the Spanish language, not just the Spanish language. So when it comes to finding teachers who are qualified in Spanish, in science or social studies, and because remember what I said earlier, we want to vary the classes and give them different types of academic language. So what we're doing right now is trying to find candidates that have a wide spectrum of expertise. But sometimes one of our challenges is we might have to do a history class for 1 year and a history class for another because we can't find that person or we've lost that person. So that's a continual challenge for us.
And earlier when Martha was talking about the different grants that are available for us, while they're extremely helpful in providing resources for districts, it has also expanded the number of bilingual programs in the state, which is a wonderful thing, but it does make it much more difficult for us to recruit teachers because we're all now recruiting from the same small pool of teachers. And so districts are having to spend a lot of money to go outside of the state to do recruitment. It's sometimes hard to convince people to, you know, transplant to a new state if they have roots in one state and aren't willing to move to Oregon, where they hear that it's rainy and gloomy, and Californians sometimes don't want to come up, which is where we get a lot of teachers, is from California. And then as far as retention, again, it's difficult when you have so many districts competing for the same teachers and reaching out to the same teachers to keep those teachers within your district.
Also, sort of on a solution front, we're looking at a pipeline with working with our universities and taking existing instructional assistants or folks that we feel that have the potential to be dual language teachers who speak Spanish, and help them get the credential to be teachers. Because as Christy was saying, sometimes going out and getting teachers from other places can be a challenge. Or if we get them, they might stay for a couple years and then go to somewhere else. This way, if we grow our own and have a pipeline, so to speak, we're able to perhaps retain our families, folks that live here in the community, have worked with Salem-Keizer for a long time. So we're seeking those opportunities very aggressively.
And another piece of that we have started this past year, and I believe Hillsborough also is doing the same program, is to take bilingual high school students who are interested in going into education, and we're providing their four-year education for them at Western Oregon to then come back and teach within our district. And so students who have gone through our bilingual program, students who have gone through our school system who are bilingual, will now be able to come back and teach in our district as well. So that will be an added bonus for us.
One additional challenge that we have, I think, is that there are other languages spoken in Salem-Keizer other than Spanish. We have a large population of Marshallese students, students from Chukis, from the islands of Chuk. We have students from Russia and the Ukraine. And so what we do or have been doing is providing a literacy program for, we have a Russian literacy program, and we have a, we're starting up a Marshallese literacy program. But being able to find qualified teachers, say, in Marshallese, which is an oral language, or Chukis, has proven to be pretty challenging to do that. So we're interested in going in those directions if we can find the right folks. But then remember, there's also resources and books that have to be in those languages as well. So those are some continual challenges and perhaps why we're not expanding at this point, but would love to.
And some of the other opportunities that we have taken in our district in order to help retain our teachers and to build their capacity is offering a lot of specialized professional development for them. We're partnering with Western Oregon to do a Spanish reading endorsement program so that our teachers can really learn how to appropriately instruct Spanish literacy, because it is different than instructing English literacy. And we also have a large group of binational teachers that are here from Mexico and Spain, and they provide Spanish language development courses for our teachers who are not native Spanish speakers, like myself, for example, who learned Spanish and became fluent in Spanish but maybe are still missing some of those really high-level grammatical pieces. And so they're able to provide support for our teachers in our district as well, or our bilingual teachers who were born and raised here and maybe were never educated in Mexico or in Spain. So we're providing those supports in our district to help retain our teachers and to make sure that they are as highly qualified as they could possibly be. And in one way that we have filled a lot of our vacancies is with binational teachers. We have 22 in our district right now from Mexico and Spain. And while that is a wonderful resource, they can only come for 3 years at a time. And so they come on a visa that allows them to come for 3 years. And it's been a really wonderful experience because we get to learn a lot from them and about the educational systems in their countries. However, it does take a lot of time and resources to provide support for them as they come into a different school system and are teaching in the United States. It does take a lot of professional development for them to be able to teach here as well.
Well, I would say that there are definitely some challenges and in moving forward. I think on a positive note, I think we're closer together than we ever have been in terms of a system throughout Oregon. We are having ongoing dialogue from different departments and how each one is doing it. We're looking to support each other. There's an equity unit at the Oregon Department of Education, which has been really helpful in that creation. They are our partners, and Martha, we work closely with her, and a great resource. We've seen the benefits firsthand. We've read the research, we've listened to the experts, and we've seen it play out in our own district. And it is something that we're very excited about and feel that there's great future for our children in dual language.
And just in closing, one of the other kind of barriers for us is the accountability piece, that our students do get assessed in English when they're still learning English and still acquiring the language. And so ODE has done a lot of work in this department as well, helping to bring assessments that are appropriate for our Spanish-speaking students as they acquire the language, so that we can demonstrate the growth that our students are having in elementary school and the success that they're having with their academic achievement. And so, as Brad said, ODE has been a great partner with bilingual education, and it's nice to have a state department that is partnering with the districts to support these programs.
Very good. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Worked with teachers from Hillsboro, Forest Grove, and Hood River for a long time. And the programs you're talking about, I know Forest Grove did this. We're working on this 15 years ago. And the idea that you teach kids skills in their native language when they're in kindergarten, first grade, and second grade, and then the conversion into English was so much easier because they had the concepts of math and the concepts of spelling and the concepts of reading, and the transition was much smoother. But this is, and the idea of recruiting teachers has been an ongoing problem for decades. Yeah. But they also started the same sort of thing, getting instructional assistants, home growing their own. But I like the program you're having with Western. Very good. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today and sharing some of this information with us. I'm glad that you mentioned the people in Marshall Islands. And I've done a little bit of work with them, and I'm thrilled that you brought this up. Because my understanding is there's about 3,500 Marshall Island folks in the state. Salem has the largest concentration of that. So we are talking about one of the struggles has been for the Marshallese is access to programs when the number's so small. So I'd like, and you referenced that you're looking at that population. I don't know how far down that road you've traveled. Talk to me a little bit about what you were doing to serve that population and offer services, knowing that you are probably, in my humble opinion, the most well-positioned district in the state to do that. Because the largest concentration of Marshall Island folks are right here.
Mm-hmm. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Springer, thank you for the question. Yes, the Marshallese, what we do, we've hired a community resource specialist. She works for me at Instructional Services, and she is a key link to our community. She's the one who attends their meetings, fosters the relationships. We find out the needs from the community through her. She sits on several boards in the state, and we have been exploring with her a relationship with the community, but also with Four Corners Elementary School, in order to have a community literacy center, and it's still in its early stages, so in terms of how that would look, we're still in that developmental phase. But we're doing a planning year this year, and then with next year with the idea of having a literacy center. So our Russian Literacy Center, we're kind of taking it right now as a model for that. The Russian Literacy Center is where we're teaching the students their native language, because they all speak English, and now they're learning Russian after school. Mm-hmm. And it's a parent and child participation to some degree. With Marshallese, we're also looking to see what the needs are, how we can best support the community, and what kind of program would best serve those needs for the families. So right now, I'm just in the process of listening, understanding where what they need from us, mm-hmm. and then we will be looking to serve the program. It may look very different from our Russian literacy program at the end, but at this point, it's just, you know, how can we... is it the native language that we want to work on, or is it, or are there some other issues that they would like to us to address and help them? And so we're having this ongoing dialogue at this point.
Thank you for that. And I'd like to actually stay in communication about that, and if there's support that this body needs to lend to that, I'd like to talk about that. Yeah. An incredibly underserved population in our state that we have a trust agreement with nation to nation and need to serve those needs. A separate question, mm-hmm. Madam Chair? Thank you. You'd mentioned earlier, you talked about the 90-10% split, mm-hmm. and then the 50-50% split for instruction. I am not the ELL expert up here by any means, so I need you to help me understand what it looks like in the classroom for the student when we're talking about 50-50 split. I would assume that does not mean this subject is in one language and this subject's in another. I would assume that doesn't mean this day it's this language, this day it's the next language. How do you create that balance, and what does it look like? And if my assumptions were wrong, so be it.
Thank you for the question, Representative Springer. At Grant Community School, we have a 90-10 model, which means that at first and kindergarten, 90% of the instruction, classroom instruction, is in Spanish, with a small portion of the day focused on English literacy. And we add a little more English as we move up to the through the years. Currently, the 50-50 instruction at Grant occurs only in fifth grade, and the way that we do that is by having one teacher teach the English portion and one teacher teach the Spanish literacy. And so the children start the day with one teacher and midday go with the other teacher to learn mathematics, ELD, English language development, and social studies and science in English. In other program, in other schools, they do have a 50-50 model in earlier years, and I'll let Chrissy explain that.
Sure. So in if you start with a 50-50 model in kindergarten, you would have a literacy component in both languages. So you would have a different purpose in your literacy, though. You wouldn't just teach the same thing in English and then again the same thing in Spanish. So you would have two different objectives for your literacy component, and you would have them in each language. And then after that, you decide how you want to separate up the different content areas. So you may do science in Spanish, and you may do math in English. And you typically keep it consistent for the year. It depends on which researcher you talk to. There are a lot of different ways that you can split up a 50-50 program. There are some researchers who say that you should go back and forth. So you should do one unit in Spanish for math, one unit in English, one in Spanish, one in English, and go back and forth. There are other researchers who say, no, you would do Spanish the whole year for math, and then maybe the next year in fourth, and you know, if you do that in kindergarten, then in first grade, your math would be in English. And so you can kind of switch back and forth between the years, between the units. It really depends on which body of research you buy into. But typically, schools will split it, literacy in both languages, and then you split up the content areas based on different languages. But with the main point being that you would never want to teach the same thing in English and in Spanish, because kids would then just wait to hear it in the language they're the most comfortable with.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of getting at. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? Representative Reardon?
I'm just curious, with so many, you know, different languages and different things to deal with, are you familiar with and do you use open educational resources? Does that ring a bell?
Okay. Say it again, the open educational
resources. Open educational resources. They're actually, like your textbooks, I'll butcher this, but your textbooks available online in a form that the teacher can access and customize for their own use. And they're just something that's being implemented probably at university level, certainly.
Yeah, and there might be a potential resource. Language programs, yeah. Curriculum programs.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we're not using those at this
okay.
time.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, and thank you very much for what you guys are doing. Appreciate
thank you
it.
Very much.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, and then last but not least, we have paper to digital instruction process with the we've got Skip Offenheiser from Menlo Pine. Did I butcher it enough for you? Yeah.
Offenheiser.
Thank you.
So it's very
Skip
nice.
O.
It's very nice to know that I'm standing between you and the end of your day, probably. So.
We are all very alert here.
Huh?
That's Jeff.
Okay, welcome.
A Japanese surfer.
Oh, we're up here having very serious things of checking out your tie.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a Snoopy tie.
Okay, from here it looks sort of Asian.
Yeah. So I'm Skip Offenheiser. I'm the Director of Instructional Technology and Curriculum from Ben Lapine School. So thank you very much for having me to talk about, the title is Paper to Digital Teaching or Paper to Digital Instruction. And what I'm going to talk about is more than that. Mm-hmm. It's more than just replacing paper books with digital books. It's more about changing the way that we instruct, changing the way we learn, and but it does involve trying to reduce the paper books and use a more digital form also. In Ben Lapine, we call this our digital conversion. So whenever we refer to this in our community, whenever we refer to this to our students, our teachers, families, our board, we refer to it as our digital conversion. Little bit of context with our digital conversion, and obviously I don't know how to use this computer, and I'm the director here. See, I am not an IT person.
Okay.
My background was as a teacher. I taught ELL for 2 years in Beaverton, then taught sixth grade in Beaverton. Was a dean of students in Beaverton, then transitioned to the Redmond School District, and then transitioned to the Ben Lapine mm-hmm. School District, where I was a principal for 6 years. So I am all about instruction. I know how to do things with computers. I know nothing about how they work.
Okay.
So, and you can just ask my wife that too. So a little bit of context about our program. Like I said, this is all about instruction. This has nothing to do with being an iPad project, has nothing to do with it being a tech project. It is all about instruction and changing the way that we do business. It is transforming from a paper-based to digital. It also means giving all of our teachers the tools that they need to work and to give our kids a 21st century schools and knowledge of the four C's. It also means providing all of our students from third grade through 12th grade with their own device that they take to and from school to home. A little bit of context of our program. We started 3 years ago, and at that time I was a building principal, and I was lucky enough to be chosen as one of the schools that would enter into the digital conversion. There were six elementary schools, one full high school, and then just the ninth grade of another high school. It was a program that we competed for, put in our plan to become the pilot schools. That's sometimes smart, sometimes not, because when you're the pilot school, you are out in the forefront and you are really experiencing all the mistakes that can be made. Last year, I took over as the director, and we moved into year two. In year two, we decided to go in and backfill all of our high school students were provided with a device. We also thought that many of our fifth graders a year before had devices, so we probably should make sure they have those devices as sixth graders too. So last year was all of our high schools, and all of our sixth grade plus our two K-8 schools were brought on board. This year, we have completed phase three as of last week, and what we have now is every student, grades 3 through 12 within our district, have all those students do have a device that they take to and from school. That was a huge undertaking. By the second week of school, we had deployed almost 14,000 iPads to kids alone. Another 2,000 or so going out to staff members. So now that we are fully deployed, now comes the hard work, and that is making sure that what we have invested our taxpayer dollars in, that we're doing something with it. Before we started with anything, though, and this is my recommendation to any school district that might think about going forward, is you have to start with the why. This was not my idea. I'm fully invested in this idea, and I'm helping to lead it. It was the thought of our board and our new superintendent, Shay Michelson. If you're familiar with him, he's a very forward-thinking person. And he did a fabulous job of framing the why to our community, to our board, to our teachers. And by starting with the why, now you have something to always fall back on. I won't be shy about saying that we've had our little bumps and bruises and trips along the way, but when we have those those little bumps and bruises and trips, we have something to fall back on, and that is the why. We don't run away at the first sign of difficulties. So after you've defined the why, you need to then start with your steps to success. And there are 9 steps to success that we took from Project RED. And just because you have these steps all laid out and you know what you're going to do next doesn't mean you're going to have success, because you're constantly going back and refining them, reflecting on them, and moving forward to what the next step would be to make it a positive experience for everybody. So the first step is to plan, and plan again. And this being the third year that we have deployed out to students, I can't tell you how important that is to plan and to always think about how you can make things different. From the first year to the third year, we've changed many of the things that we've done. The first year was a little bit difficult. Apple has worked with us considerably to make those much easier. I think this year we have our rollouts. I can point to our rollouts at Bend High, where we rolled out to 1,400 students over 2 days as a success, and that's only because we were planning and always looking at what we could do differently. The next is to have a shared vision. That kind of goes back to the why. But you need to communicate that with all of your stakeholders. And when you communicate that with all of your stakeholders at the school, within the teaching staff, with your community, then it makes the process much easier. I try to work every single one of our digital rollouts to interact with the students, the teaching staff, but with the parents. And usually I get at least one, maybe two parents that have reservations about what we're doing. And after I'm able to take some time and explain to them, I can usually bring them around to thinking that this is a good thing. But when you think about maybe rolling out to an elementary school with 300 parents there, and you only have one, maybe two, that have reservations, that's pretty good. And that tells me that the board and that Shay, when he was had this idea, that we did things right, and we started with the why, and we communicated that very successfully. Our next step is to align resources. And what this means is that we need to think of things differently. We have lots of resources within our school district, and there's nothing that says that we have to use our resources the same way year in and year out. And that's how we at Ben Lapine are making this happen, is we're looking at different ways with how we use our things. And those things are from money to our human capital. We have to realize that just because things were done a certain way doesn't mean that they always have to be done that way. So that's how we've looked at our dollars, we've looked at our departments, we've looked at our staffing within our schools, and decided that, you know, just because we have these people or these dollars here and we've used them this way, we don't have to use them in the future the same way. So it's aligning the resources under that common vision. Probably the most important is to focus on student achievement. We have a saying in my department with our teachers. We tell them, don't do tech for tech's sake. We shouldn't walk into a classroom and see just technology being used and wonder or be wowed by it, but then leave going, wow, I wonder what the kids are actually learning there. We train our teachers and try to send the message of, you need to balance that. And there is a time with the iPad that you put it away, mm-hmm. because it's not the most appropriate tool to be used for that time. But what we like to see is that intersection of depth of knowledge and instructional technology, where it reaches that perfect balance, where the students and the teachers are using it in productive ways, that we're not forcing it on the kids, or we're not using it in ways where instructionally it doesn't make sense. It might look really cool, but from an instructional standpoint, there's not a lot of learning going on. We also have to focus on fostering our leadership. I give my schools the leeway to make their own plan. Every school submits a plan for their digital conversion. And from Bend High to Summit High to Pilot Butte Middle School to Buckingham Elementary, all of those plans are different because every school is different and every staff is different, every community is different. We still have some of our tights where we have to do certain things, but we have our loose parts too, and we allow them that freedom to help make this happen underneath their own school, in their own community, and their own culture within that school. And I have been pushed at times. I have schools that want to do certain things, and there's no way that this is going to be successful if it's top down, and I like to listen to them. And if it's reasonable and they have sound reasons behind it, then we try to make it happen. Sometimes we can't, and I will explain that to them, but in most cases, I want them to be successful, and if I can make something happen, I will. Number six is you need to establish a digital infrastructure, and this not only means you need to make sure you have, you know, all your wiring in place and that you have the tech support that you need, but simple little things of what do you do when you get off the bus and you have an iPad in your hand, having little simple policies in place for that. What do you do when you have 300 families that show up in one night and you need to roll out your iPads in an efficient way? Is having those structures in place that account for something that's much, much different than what you're used to doing. It's much different to hand a student an iPad than it is to hand them a regular textbook. There's some different things that you have to account for. So having that established infrastructure in place and having a team in place at every school, and like I said, every school runs it just a little bit differently. But they need to account for it. Number seven is very personal to me, is you need to build capacity and build capacity within your staff. Every staff, every teacher comes to us with a different set of skills. My wife comes to us with a very low level of tech skills, and she'll be the first to tell you that. But we need to support those teachers no matter where they are in the spectrum to bring them up and give them the skills that they need to make them feel successful within the classroom. And we adhere to the SAMR model, which is it's a SAMR, and we start with the S, and the S stands for substitution. It is okay to start off, if this is brand new to you, and we have 10 elementary schools where this is brand new to them, it's okay to just substitute some things that you normally did, paper and pencil. Let's start off by substituting technology for those. It may look very pedestrian, but it's a start, and that's a starting place for them. My wife, she was not very happy when she found out that her school was going to be part of the digital conversion in year one, and she's very technophobe. Just this year, I got her to learn how to text. She was not texting, and now I can't get her off the texting. But she, like I said, was very hesitant, and by the end of the year, she didn't want to give up the iPads with her kids. And then to start off the next year, when I was in charge then, she was very upset that she was going to have to wait 2 weeks before we could get to her classroom to give her her iPads. Her biggest use for using the iPads is she says that, you know, if you think about it, I have the sum of the world's knowledge at my kids' fingertips right here. Mm-hmm. And she used those regularly with her kids in ways like that. The digital conversion also has the opportunity for us to personalize instruction. It also gives us the opportunity to accumulate data on our kids that really drives our instruction. And I'm not saying that we're testing our kids all the time, but with the tools that we have, we can get information on our students much more readily, much more easily. And we can implement ways to personalize education in ways we've never been able to do before. We can bring in blended learning. We can use tools such as iTunes U to put classes up on the iPad that can be taken home and can be brought back without any connectivity needed. Once the student downloads an iTunes U course, it is part of that device, and they can work on it at home, on the bus, wherever they are. I think number nine for our teachers, for our administrators, for our whole community is rethinking the instructional process and how it and what it looks like in the classroom. In this picture right here, this is a picture of an art class at Summit High School, and if I had the video of it, it would capture that much better. But these students are sharing their artwork, and in behind there's another group that's sharing their artwork. And these are things that they did on their iPads. And the rich discussion that was going on may not have occurred in a traditional classroom with these tools. It might have, but this was the iPads helped facilitate this process. Also, there's I like to tell a story about a fourth grade teacher, Ray Page, who is at Juniper Elementary, and I was taking school visitors over to his classroom, and before we came into the classroom, he had to stop us, and he had to tell us. He says, "I'm not going to let you go in." He says, "I got to tell you all about what's going on right now." He said, "This has changed the way that I teach writing," and this is from a 20-year veteran. He said, "I've never had anything change my teaching as this has changed my teaching with the iPad," and he uses Google Docs with his students, and he's able to confer. He's able to edit. He's able to do so much more writing with the students in an interactive way using Google Docs and the kids having their own individual iPad. So after he told us what was going on in the classroom and expressed his enthusiasm for the project, we went in, and I sat down and talked to a few kids, and just to verify that he wasn't just giving us, you know, a story. And every student could talk about how their writing has improved and how Mr. Page is able to give them feedback that was very specific to what they needed and what they were doing in a very interactive way. So it's just rethinking the way that we teach, the rethinking how we envision how the classroom functions in a 21st century, very interactive, collaborative fashion. So those are kind of the nine steps that we that you go through. And Project Red, I said, outlines those. I'm going to leave it up to questions now. And that's the Ben Lapine story, where we are right now in our third year. We didn't roll this out all in one fell swoop, 14,000 iPads in 1 year. We worked our way up to this, and we are right on pace to where we thought we would be 3 years ago.
Okay, questions. Representative McLean.
Did Apple take the camera out of your iPads?
No. And it's interesting you just brought that up. Our cameras are there. Mm-hmm. I just received an email from our assistant superintendent wanting to know what the policy is on kids taking pictures, because she said there were kids taking pictures on the bus. And I just took a screenshot of our acceptable use policy and said, here it is. They signed their acceptable use that they would not take pictures without the permission of the person who's getting their picture taken.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. That one was, I thought about that too, but yeah. The one that I was concerned, the first time I used iPads in a classroom with seniors, I had one boy that had taken 800 pictures before, you know, I mean, it was just dumb stuff in the classroom. And so then at night I discovered it when I was cleaning them off and plugging them in and doing all those things, because we don't have one for each student. We had to have class sets and things like that, but that was an issue. And the other issue was the idea of, do you have teachers saying to you, my kids expect instant response, which means like right now?
Yes and no. And that's part of, back to the camera one, what I look at is, that's part of the whole digital citizenship. And there's no way that we're holding back all of our, we're holding back this technology. It's there. It's a tsunami. So we might as well embrace it and use it for productive ways and teach kids how to use these as educational tools rather than toys, how they can be used. So with the camera, now for the feedback, usually I think it's the parents that want the feedback immediately. I have a son and daughter in the high school, and not once have they worried that they haven't gotten their feedback quick enough. My daughter maybe a little bit. My son, he's pretty happy-go-lucky.
Well, I had a speech and debate class, and, you know, that they always wanted feedback. And so, you know, you were talking about the interaction, how quickly they could do all that. Well, if my kids had that expectation, I mean, they were texting me or emailing me at midnight and wondering why I hadn't gotten back to them, you know, 7 o'clock the next morning. So I had to put limits. You may not text me. You may not email me after X, Y, and I'm not going to email you back.
And some of the tools that we're trying to teach teachers on is how can we make your job a little bit easier so you can give that feedback immediately using tools such as Socrative or Google Forms where things are self-correcting.
Okay. Yeah,
and you can get the feedback much quicker to your students.
And I agree with you on citizenship. If the technology is there, you've got to use it the right way for education purposes.
Okay, other questions?
Just a real quick question. So have these replaced textbooks?
Not 100%.
What percent do you think?
A lot of times we're waiting for the, we have several textbook publishers that we work with. Unfortunately, they all have different ways that they deploy their textbooks that would be too easy to do it the same.
Of course.
And a lot of times the textbooks, even though they may be digital,
4 minutes, yeah.
The quality of them is not what we want. Mm. So we every year go through. In fact, we're just finalizing it right now. First thing we look at is the textbook, then is it digital. So with our elementary grades, we did a reading adoption this year, and that was one thing we were looking at. Is there a digital version of it? But first and foremost, we were looking at the quality of the reading program. Mm-hmm. So the two that we looked at and considered both had digital versions, and the one that was the easiest digital version to deploy, we did not adopt. And that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm. Follow up? Mm-hmm. So are you seeing any cost reduction or any difference in costs?
Yes, we are. So in looking at our money a little at it from a different standpoint, and back to there was a question earlier about using open textbooks.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's where I think our cost savings is really going to skyrocket, is when we can identify quality open source textbooks that we can use. We have teachers that are creating their own classes on iTunes U based off of the standards, so teaching directly to the standards and bringing in their materials, which is fabulous. I've seen some math courses that are excellent. And from a cost savings, from a time savings standpoint from a teacher, being able to create a class and then the next year with very little tweaks and adjustments, just redeploy that same class and all the materials to the next year.
Thank you so much for that last example. Again, always a good reminder that if our teachers like it, it's a good thing. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, other questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Peluso's asked some of what I was thinking about as far as costs. First of all, I think it's great, and we need to, because the kids have technology.
Yep.
Not stopping it, as you said. So let's teach with it and around it. That said, so I've sat on a school board and made budget cuts. And so what has been the conversations surrounding how do we maintain this? Because I think one of the biggest failures we have in education is we start a great program and then we cut the great program. So we never know if it was successful. What have the conversations been, particularly at the board level, how you're going to sustain this? What level of priority is this to sustain? Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
So we do not do the way we budget in within Ben Lapine for this is it's not in addition to. So we look at our budget, and we have X amount of dollars that we would spend on curriculum. How could we leverage those dollars in a different way to include curriculum, but also to include the devices? If you look at the cost per day per student, it comes out to be, I think, $1.25 per student, give or take. That's what we were looking at. So we take our monies that we look at from a curriculum standpoint, we're going to purchase books. We're going to have things that we're going to purchase every single year. We look at the money that we have for technology. For instance, I've had principals come to me and saying, I need to refresh my my computer lab, and my question is, why? All of your students have iPads now. Why do we need that lab to continue in that way? So it's looking at how we use already existing dollars that are in a different way. If we did what you are kind of insinuating, where if we said we're going to use all of our curriculum dollars, all of our technology dollars, and we're going to have this too, when times get tough, we're going to cut.
Okay. So it's embedded in what you're doing.
Embedded.
It's just embedded.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
One real quick.
Yep.
Probably a mistake to ask this at this point in the evening, but you did have a slide showing student, and it was talking about having, I forget the exact term, but the program information tailored to that individual student. Mm-hmm. Are you able to protect their privacy at the student and at the district level?
It's a great question, and it's something that I'm very trying to be proactive with. I'm working with a company right now that's examining all of our apps that we use just to make sure that they fall within all of the guidelines and FERPA and COPPA and things like that. But we're trying to be very protective of our students. So when, in fact, just today we had a school that was requesting to use a certain app, and we looked at the app and said, nope, there is information that has the potential to get out there where students are having to provide personal information.
Okay, so an individual teacher or student can't just download an app on their pad then?
No, we have things... And things are changing almost on a daily basis. But for our elementary and middle school students, they are fairly locked down. If they go the App Store appears on their iPad, but if they go to the App Store and download Angry Birds, which is not on our approved app list, it will disable their iPad. For our high school students,
that's pretty harsh.
And it works. And I've got to tell the story. We were rolling these iPads out, and we had just devised this system, and a little sixth grader right in front of us didn't believe us, I guess, and he downloaded Angry Birds, and his iPad just disabled, and he's holding up saying, mine's not working. And I'm like, that's because you just downloaded that app. It was beautiful.
Some learn that way.
So for our high school students, however, because they can sign up on their own for almost every high school student, you're 14 when you go into high school, they can sign up on their own for an Apple ID. We allow them to download apps, but we have a restriction in there that only allows them to download apps that are of a certain age rating. So if there's an app that is rated 17 plus, they're not allowed to get it. It won't even download.
Okay. Quick.
Well, please. To that point, I mean, we passed a law this last session that talks a little bit more about the privacy and the kinds of things that we want companies selling and or using and or sharing. And so you might want to take a look at that, because I think that what you just told me about the high school kids, that there's still some issues.
There probably are some issues, and we're looking at that with the release of iOS 9. There's some potential there that we can remove the App Store from the high school students, but still allow them the flexibility. Our whole goal there was to provide them with some flexibility, so when that physics teacher found a really cool app that he wanted his class to download for a demonstration, he could, and not have to go through a big, long process to get it approved.
There has to be a balance
there has to be a balance.
Okay, thank you. Anything else?
Nope.
Okay, before we go, we have something, and I don't know if you guys have been noticing that Richard's been kind of wiggling up here and going like this. His wife is in... It could be any time that he becomes a first-time daddy.
Woohoo! Out, scoot.
38 weeks today.
And his wife, 38 weeks today, so his wife cannot, wait. So what we have as an education committee is we have little gifts for, if it was a girl, it would be maybe Margaret Teresa, but it's not. So we have little gifts from the education committee to our committee administrator and his very patient wife.
There you go.
Okay. And with that, I adjourn the education committee.
Nice.
Thank you so much. That's spectacular.
So cool. Education committee.
Nice.